Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Susan Krieger, and her guide dog, Tila. Susan is a professor at Stanford University. Her book, Traveling Blind, is her sixth book that she's written. Has experienced something none of us would like to experience, and she has been articulate before she went through it, and she's now an articulate observer of the process. And I think it's very, very interesting insight for anyone to get a view of what this is like. That's why we asked her to speak, and she did a great job. By the way, Susan brought audio copies of her book. That if you want the book, you can also have the audio copy, and I listened to it. It's very, very well done. And the woman who did the audio is here tonight, and she'll be reading portions of the book for Susan. So without it, Susan and Tila.
I'm getting my guide dog settled at my feet. Tila, sit.
Good girl.
I'm glad that we have such a nice turnout tonight. Let's see. I'll make some introductory remarks. I'm Susan Krieger, and I am a sociologist and a writer. I teach in the program in feminist studies at Stanford University, and I'm here tonight to talk with you about my new book, Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision with a Guide Dog by My Side, which was published by Purdue University Press in the end of 2010. What I'd like to do is to give you a taste of the book, a sense of what it's about, and my talk will be punctuated by readings from a couple of the chapters by Ann Richardson, who's an audiobook narrator and who's recorded the book. So I hope that you will enjoy it and we'll leave plenty of time for questions. To begin with, I should say that I'm going to pause for a moment. Tell my dog we don't lick our feet in public. I am unusual for a sociologist in that I write ethnography, which are studies of particular situations and particular experiences in order to make more general knowledge contributions. I also am unusual because in recent years I've taken to writing personal ethnography, which means I draw on my own personal experiences in order to make my contributions within the social sciences. Now, I will be speaking about the book in terms of my personal experiences, and I'll also suggest to you some of the more general points. I would also like to mention at the outset that my blindness, my eye condition that informs this book, is called birdshot retinochoroidopathy, and this is a rare autoimmune eye disease that I've had since about 1996. It started as an inflammation of my choroid, spread to my retina, it caused swelling and scarring on my retina. And the results are symptoms somewhat like a combination of glaucoma and macular degeneration, in that there are blind areas in the center of my vision and blind areas on the peripheries. It means that in addition to these blind areas, I have a darkening of my vision, distortions, lack of color vision, failure of depth perception. I'll see something maybe right here in front of me, but not see the thing right next to it that may also be in front of me. It's a scattershot. That's why they call it birdshot, because it's as if someone shot a rifle with birdshot onto my retina and resulted in this scattershot blindness. So I see to some extent, but I also have this significant blindness. And one experience I had prior to the writing of this book was that I was walking across a street in San Francisco, and a car hit me that I didn't see coming because it was in a blind spot in my peripheral vision over here somewhere, tossed me up on the hood, threw me onto the sidewalk. And, yeah, before I knew what was happening, and fortunately, I was not severely hurt, but I was very frightened, and it was a sign that I had to pay attention to, which is that I shouldn't assume that I see. Just because I see one thing doesn't mean I'll see the thing next to it, and I had to take greater care with my mobility. Started to use a cane, and very soon I wanted to have a guide dog for greater safety in mobility. So I went to guide dog school in San Rafael, California, to Guide Dogs for the Blind, where I lived for a month and then came home with this wonderful golden retriever, yellow Labrador cross. Her name is Tila, T-E-E-L-A, and often when I say that name, she jumps up, comes to attention, and asks me what I'd like her to do, where I'd like her to take me. Right now, I think she's used to that we're just lying here while I talk for half an hour, but I didn't know what she'd do. So I came up with this guide dog, and this is the origins of the book. Very soon after I came home, I became aware that somehow the world was opening up to me. It was as if my life became a new adventure. And 3 months after starting that sense of adventure, I thought, being a sociologist and a writer, I wanted to write about it. I wanted to share some of what I was experiencing and also come to terms with it better myself. And so I began writing this book that's resulted in Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision with a Guide Dog by my side. And to give you a sense of it, the book opens with a trip that I take 2 months after coming home with my dog, with my guide dog Tila and my partner Hannah, and we go off to a remote area of the southern New Mexico desert because I like remote areas, and I can no longer drive. My partner's willing to drive, and my mind is set on visiting a mountain, and I am very happy in this part of the country because, especially with my loss of sight, there can be very bright, big skies and big clouds, and a mountain is big, you know, so that I can look forward to being able to register these big images, whereas the small things, like the nature of the plants by the roadside and a lot of the details, stores and whatnot, that I once was able to see are not going to be that available to me. So we go off, and I write about this in the opening chapter, and I wish to convey to the reader my sort of joy in being able to see these big things. At the same time, my frustration, because even a mountain is very murky and hard for me to see. And I describe, I think, in one of the initial chapters, how we get to this mountain, and I want to be able to see it better, because even though it's big, it's murky to me. And I tumble out of the car with my guide dog to aid me, my partner to sort of tell us if we're going to get into some danger she doesn't see. I have a 12-power binoculars around my neck and a camera with a telephoto lens, because I am determined to make use of what sight I have. And I stand there and I look at the mountain with the binoculars that I used to use for bird watching. And I try to make out what my partner can probably see with the naked eye. So I have these aids. And the story of our trip through the desert is in part a story of my straining to see on the one hand, using my aids very often, and then alternately saying, I just want to let this murky, fuzzy, blurry scenery pass me by and enjoy the changes of the light, whatever I can see. Let my partner describe it to me. Let my dog lead me through it. It's a bit of a conflict. I think many blind people may face it, you know, who have some degree of sight, between trying to strain to see to use your sight and just feeling, I mean, it's not worth it sometimes. Better to enjoy the fuzziness or the darkness and to navigate through that more fully blind. So I open trying to convey a positive sense of my experience despite my loss of sight and to reveal some of the dilemmas. In the middle section of the book, we're back in San Francisco and we are in airports. Because I have to get on a plane to get to the desert, and I live in San Francisco, and I want to take the reader with me on some of those travels. So one of the things that is very interesting in the middle there is a chapter I call Airport Stories, where I attempted to put together many of the brief stories that I had experienced while going through airports, from the first with my guide dog. And airports with security are a challenge for any person. And with any amount of disability or a metal piece in your arm or leg or some, you know, they're a challenge. Well, a blind person with a new guide dog, they're a challenge in specific ways. I wanted to illustrate those that can be humorous as well as educative, I suppose. And I have a story of in there, in my airport stories, of the very first time I come home with her. We're on our first trip. We go through security, the scaffolding, and, you know, her harness has got metal in it. It will set off the alarm. So she's supposed to go through the thing. We set off the alarm. I say, lie down on the other side of the scaffold. Then I step back. Then I go through, and hopefully I don't set off the alarm. But at that very first time and every time since then, the security people say to me, got to pat down your dog. And I was shocked at first. What do? They want to touch my dog. I learned at guide dog school, no one should touch your dog. She'll get distracted. She won't guide you properly. And I had visions of in the airport, she would walk up to every person who had a uniform and say, pet me. You know, so I said, I know I just barked at them, don't touch my dog. You can't touch my dog. You anything to me, spread my arms. And luckily she had short hair, and I have barked at them on every airport trip since then, and no one touches my dog. And I'm lucky she has short hair, but that was my initial story, one of my initial stories in that chapter. There are quite a few more, each with their own moral. And I'm going to ask Anne, who has selected a particular excerpt from Airport Stories, to illustrate it for you and give you some sense of traveling through airports with a guide dog, especially in the early period. Anne Richardson is a professional audiobook narrator, and something very special. She's narrated the audiobook, which I'll mention later, we have available as a gift to you, along with a purchase of the book. And even if you don't purchase the book and you would like the gift of it, I have brought extra copies, and you can buy the book or refer the book to friends later on if you like it. But it's a very special very special to have this audiobook and to have Anne with us.
Hello. Thank you. This is from the chapter called Airport Stories. Not long ago, when Hannah, Tila, and I were traveling cross-country to visit Hannah's family in Pennsylvania, we had to change planes in Atlanta. Before boarding the connecting flight, I needed to find a place for Tila to relieve herself. At the gate, I spoke to an attendant. "Can you call someone to take me to an outdoor area where my dog can relieve?" I asked. "They won't come," he said. "We're understaffed, but I can call a wheelchair for you." "I don't need a wheelchair. I requested a person when I checked in." He thought a moment. "I'd let you out right here," he offered, motioning to the ramp behind him. "But the last one we let out ran away. We can't do that anymore." I had images of Tila bounding off across the tarmac. "Can you call customer service for me?" I asked. "They won't come here, but you can go there yourself, or you can just take her out the front door of the airport yourself." He pointed in the direction of a walkway. "Exactly where is customer service?" I asked. "I can't see where you're pointing to." "Back there, over the overpass." "Exactly where, after the overpass? Is it on the left or on the right? Can you give me more specific directions?" "On the left. After you pass the escalator, turn left to the overpass, and it will be on your left." Hannah, Tila, and I set off. At customer service, we found a long line of people waiting. I wanted to go right up to the desk and tell them that my dog had to pee, but I waited. A roaming customer service representative walked down the line, asking what people needed. "I need someone to take me to an outside area where my dog can relieve herself. Then I need help back so I can have priority through security." The representative went on to the next person. Hannah nudged me soon after that. "They want you up front," she said. "They were waving to you, but you didn't see them. Go straight ahead to the desk." At that moment, I was more surprised by the fact that I had not seen the airport attendants waving to me than by the fact that they were waving to a blind person with a guide dog. I walked up to the desk and explained my situation. "No one's free to go with you right now," the customer service attendant said. "You can take your dog out the front door yourself." I began stuttering. It was a big airport. I would have to get on and off a train. In the back of my mind, I knew that Hannah had offered to guide me and Tila to the airport's front door, but I had declined. I needed to know I could do this myself, that I could ask for help in an airport and be given it. For the next time, I might be traveling alone. Finally, a customer service representative appeared and led us down corridors, through a back door, out a service elevator and into the basement, and then onto a train for several stops and off, and out into a lobby and to a side door. There, Tila and I stepped out into the warmth of the sunlight. The attendant pointed to a grassy area in a corner. Tila led me over to it, sniffed the grass and the scent of many before her, and peed. I marveled that I was ever expected to get here by myself. I got Tila ready and we were off again, following the representative, then on our own, back down the walkway, on and off the train, onto an elevator, up out of the basement, through the corridors and to the gate. At the gate, I finally caught my breath. Tila had peed and we were all now safely back in time for our connecting flight. But it hadn't been pleasant. Neither the rushing through the airport, through surroundings I couldn't see, nor my sense that I could not find my way home, nor my need to insist, over and over again, that I should have assistance.
Thank you, Anne. So that's one of my airport stories, Atlanta. And that reading reminds me the way it ends, you know, concerning my need to ask for assistance. My microphone, I have to hold it close. One of the things I have realized increasingly at airports and elsewhere, you know, in this request for directions and guidance, is that my loss of sight requires that I ask for assistance, and that I ask very specifically for the kind of assistance I need, because people don't necessarily know. You know, they don't know that over there is kind of an odd direction to give to a blind person, or that it needs to be very, very specific. So the burden is on me to assert specifically what I need, which is a hard thing, especially for a woman. You grow up thinking, you know, you don't need anything and you should never ask, and you have to ask. So in terms of asking, there's a related chapter in the middle of the book called Are You Training That Dog?, where I also have to relate to others in terms of their expectations of me and what I might need or who I am. And this chapter began because I wanted to write about and explore my experience on the streets of San Francisco, especially being asked by people from the moment I left Guide Dog School, brought Teal home, started walking with her, people would ask me, are you training that dog? You know, and they asked it kind of frequently, and I thought at first, I must really be doing something wrong. Am I standing up straight? Am I doing what they taught us, stopping at the curbs and all this? And I checked that out, and they were still asking. And, you know, a guide dog, when they lead, she stops at all curbs to show me that we're at the street and to show me there's a change in elevation. Then I decide when I think traffic is not there, and we cross unless she decides that traffic is there. When I'm not, and then we don't cross away, we cross. And then she weaves. They follow an edge, and she weaves around garbage cans, and she weaves around scaffoldings and around anything that she thinks is going to be dangerous to us. And I follow. You know, you lose some of your own initiative. I can tell her we want to go straight, we want to go right or left, but she's going to do the route. And it's a different kind of experience. Sometimes I would even begin to think, this must be I'm a dog, you know, because I'm so much traveling through the world through a dog's eyes. So, but I was asked that question very often. And it bothered me because here I had gone to guide dog school. I needed a dog because I was hit by a car because I didn't see. I'm weaving my way on the streets, you know, just saying, my life is in your hands. And people don't see me as blind. They're asking me, are you training that dog? I think because they think, maybe you're sighted, because I didn't fulfill perhaps the stereotype of a blind woman, which probably should be someone who was more incompetent than me, or whose eyes look more injured, since the injury to my eyes is in the back. Nobody sees it, and because I see some light and I see shapes, to some extent my eyes will move and focus on them, and people may expect a blind person's eyes don't move. Whatever those stereotypes, that might not be true, because most blind people have some degree of visual sight, and there are all kinds of invisible blind people that look like sighted people. Whatever that is, it's operating there, I thought, and I would often need to stop and explain to people that she's a guide dog, I'm training her, you can't see what's wrong with my eyes, but still, you know, looking out through my eyes, there are problems, and we would have a discussion, and sometimes I would ignore the question, just thinking, I don't want to answer it this day. So eventually I wrote my chapter, trying to talk back to every person who had ever asked me, are you training that dog? But also, it was to settle within myself the unsettlement that resulted when I was asked that question, because it made me question my own identity. Am I really blind? Am I blind enough to have this dog? Maybe I shouldn't have the dog. And then I would stumble on something. I would say, oh, thank goodness, there's a reason I have this dog, you know, because I don't see very well. And the writing enabled me to settle, most importantly, some of my inner dilemmas that this question raised. And Anne is going to read a bit to give you a sense of that question on the streets of San Francisco.
This is from Chapter 8, Are You Training That Dog? I am standing at an intersection about to cross a busy street. A man walks up to me from behind and begins to talk to me. I step off the curb. He steps off with me, continuing to talk. Is that a guide dog? He asks. Are you training that dog? I had a cousin who trained one of those dogs. As I hear him, I try to listen behind his words for the oncoming traffic. I need to pay attention to Tila. I have to give her clear signals with my hands and feet concerning our direction and when to step up and down on the curbs. If I talk to the man at the same time as crossing, I will distract Tila, who may mistake my conversation for a command. I'm out walking with Hannah in a different part of town now. Tila is guiding me, so I'm slightly ahead, with Hannah a few steps behind my right shoulder, enabling Tila to see to both sides. A man comes up quickly from behind us and cuts between Hannah and me. He begins keeping pace with me. "Are you training that dog?" he asks. "She's working," I say, trying to ignore him. But he tags along with me as if glued, leaving Hannah pushed aside. "I see them downtown," he continues. "Do you train her downtown? I know a lot about them. I saw it on TV. I'm not sure which is the greater indignity, his cutting in between Hannah and me or his relentless questioning. I'm in a coastal town waiting for Hannah on a sidewalk outside a Mexican restaurant where she is ordering our takeout lunch. A man walks over to me. "Are you training that dog?" he asks. I explain that she is already trained. "I don't see very well," I say to the man, thinking to myself, why can't I simply say I'm blind? I've become determined not to look up at people on sidewalks in the future. Then maybe they won't feel they have eye contact with me and they won't talk to me. I often give eye contact without my knowing, since I will see the shape of a person's face, but because of the features are blurred, I will not realize that I'm staring into their eyes. Such contact invites response, even when I do not want it. When I first got Tila and people began asking me, "Are you training that dog?" I answered by saying, "No, she's already trained." More questions would follow. "What's her name? How long have you had her? How old is she? She looks like a nice dog. You're very lucky. How long was her training?" I would have to engage in a conversation to answer these questions. Some days I got asked if I was training Tila almost every time I went out. The "are you training" inquiry soon began to anger me, which was my way of putting up an emotional armor in the face of what felt like assaultive words. To avoid being questioned, I began wearing my dark glasses even when I did not need them. I started to avoid looking directly at people, adopting a fixed gaze or looking down at the ground, stumbling, or leaving a silence after the question, as if I had not heard it or did not think it was intended for me. I would look to the side of a person's face when we spoke, trying to appear more blind than I was. I tried wearing no glasses, distance glasses, wraparound dark glasses, but people asked me anyway. Why do people assume sightedness when faced with a blind person? Why do I? I assume, because like others, I have learned deeply that to be blind means not to see at all, to stumble, to fall, to need help, to suffer the handicap of lack of sight, that it means a condition that is both total and disabling. Sometimes I do stumble, sometimes I fall, sometimes I see, but at other times I do not. When I think about why my blindness so often goes unnoticed, I consider that, too, that the clues that point to it may be subtle. A difference in the harness that Tila wears that indicates she's a guide dog. A difference in how I act at curbs. A cautiousness. A hidden watchfulness. The suggestion of my terror on stairs. There are many people like me.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to have my magical watch tell me the time. Because I want to make sure to leave enough time for the questions and discussions and perhaps sharing of some of your experiences. So there we have, "Are you training that dog?" which is a way for me also to talk about my own inner dilemmas and my attempt to come to terms with this dual identity. I have a chapter in the book called Navigating Duality, where I talk about the fact that I am sighted to some extent, but also blind to some extent, and how do I navigate this? And I think that though I'm talking about my own blindness, when I wrote that, I also had in mind other people who navigate dual identities. Let's say they're Spanish-speaking and English-speaking, or have one parent from another country and one parent from American-born, or Afro-American heritage and Euro-American. So these other mixtures where people have to navigate two different parts of their identity, often needing to identify with one part. And in my case, I needed very much and have needed to identify with a blind aspect of my identity, because what I found and I describe in the book is that if I ignore it, I bump into a wall. And that sight, it's an interesting thing with blindness and sight, that sight in my experience, is so overwhelming a sense that it tends to overwhelm my awareness of my blindness. You know, I think I see what's straight in front of me. You know, the path is clear and a car hits me. The whole adage that, you know, if you see it, it's real, it's really there. You know, it's a very dominant sense. And so to pay attention to something that's invisible, what's not there I don't see, you know, it requires constant attention. And that is a reason why I have had to kind of navigate this inner duality, and especially learn to navigate it in a way that requires me to constantly recognize my blindness, because my sight is so dominant a sense. So I discuss this in that chapter, and it relates to something toward the end of the book. In the last third of the book, we go back, the three of us, my guide dog, my partner, and I, to the New Mexico desert, where I like to go. And I have this experience of being extremely anxious, because I don't know if the things that I once saw will be as clear to me. Will I be able to see them again? Even if I don't see them, will I be able to enjoy my experience? And it has occurred to me, you know, that many blind people have this. Their parents take them, or someone takes them to get a last view of something before it totally disappears, and you want to really savor and keep that last view because you don't know if it's still going to be there. So we go off on another trip. And as I write about it toward the end of the book, one of the lessons that I want to draw from my experience of returning and of sort of considering over the course of writing this book and over those 3 years that it covers, considering just how do I want to think about myself? How do I come to terms with my own inner identity? How do I navigate that at the same time as this new dog causes me to navigate the world with an ability to look up, you know, and to have more interaction with people? They may ask me bothersome questions, but it makes me interactive and social, and I'm a writer and a scholar and very much of an introvert. So I think it's actually been good for me to answer these questions. So there's this outer navigation, but also the inner navigation. And one lesson for myself that I draw is that I seem to think it's very important for me to accept the individuality of my own way of seeing and not seeing. You know, I become aware that I see things in a way others don't, and I am blind to things others are not blind to. And I also think that's so with every person, sighted or blind, that each person has their own individual vision, and our common conversation is about ways of seeing that we can share, and we're each quiet about how. This is kind of my view of it, but, you know. And so in writing my book where I present, okay, here's my inner mulling over and here are my outer experiences and all this, I try to give voice to these as honestly as I can and in a way that will take the reader with me and make the trip, you know, a pleasant experience, an interesting one. You know, giving voice to my own inner ways of seeing and understanding things, I hope that would encourage others to also do similarly, because I think it is so important to acknowledge and to accept and to give more voice to these individual ways of seeing, sighted and blind. And I think I will lead to a bit of a conclusion on this part of my presentation by saying that as I wrote Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision, with a guide dog by my side, I had in mind two audiences, not that there were the only the two, but that I was writing both for sighted people and for blind people. So I'd want to describe my visual scenery in a way that sighted people would recognize and that blind people might make some sense of, even if they couldn't see it. And the whole process of writing the book was one where I was considering these two audiences. And when it came time nearing publication, I was aware that I needed to take steps to make the book accessible to the blind as well as the sighted. Now, this has occurred with both my last two books, the sixth one and the fifth one, which was called Things No Longer There, A Memoir of Losing Sight and Finding Vision, which also was about vision loss, but in a smaller amount. It was only a smaller part of that book. The whole of this book, that was also about, you know, you go back to places of your past and they're no longer there. The only thing you have is the image in your mind and how important I think it is to keep those images. So I was about to face publication, and I made arrangement with the publisher that a PDF version of the book and a Word version that were very accessible for screen readers used by the blind that I myself use would be available to blind readers simultaneous to print publication. Because for the last two books, I have this book. It comes out. And everybody's, oh, your book is out. And they turn the pages, and I go, so, you know, it's kind of anticlimactic because I can't read the print. And I rely on the computer reading it to me or someone speaking or reading it to me. And so having the PDF version means that my screen reader in the computer can read that text to me as it did when I wrote it. And if it could be read to me, it could be read to other blind people. It could be put into machines that use refreshable Braille, and it could be read by blind people using the refreshable Braille as well as using the speech. I also approached Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic in Palo Alto, which fortunately is near Stanford, and I requested that they go to work early to get this book recorded, if they possibly could, so that it could come out simultaneous with print publication. Because one of the things for blind readers that I have found out through sore experience is that the whole world gets a new book. And my friends are, oh, read this, and I'm thinking, there's no way I can read this. It won't be available in some alternative format, if it's available, for at least a year or maybe more. And the things, it's just a very unequal playing field. Print books available for the sighted are just, I don't know, it must be 90% of what's available for the sighted is not available for the blind. And if it does, it comes late. And so for my books, I have wanted it to be as accessible as possible. At Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic, they somehow came up with Ann Richardson, who read the book so beautifully and wonderfully when it came out, when I got notice that it was available in the audio format, and I listened, I thought, my goodness, it really is good what I wrote. You know, she made my writing sound far better, and you have to realize that I've been listening to it up to that point with the computer reading it to me. Now, No, I didn't quite mean that, but I like my computer's man's voice, Jaws. Reed, that's his name. But I like his voice. It's very comforting. I hear my own voice in his, so I do like my computer voice, but there is no comparison. Anne's was just wonderful, and she read my words and made them sound far better than I ever wrote them. So I'm very, very grateful, and her recording at RFBND has become my recording of record that, you know, each page is listed that I listen to. Now, a cute thing happened a few weeks before the print book actually came out. The RFBND version was available, so the blind readers got it first. I just got a great kick out of that. And subsequently, after the book was out a couple of months, I asked Anne if she might, in her capacity as a professional audiobook narrator, record the book again, so that not only blind readers could make obtain it through RFBND, but sighted readers as well, because many people were mentioning to me, you know, oh, I like to listen to audiobooks, I listen in my car, and also many blind readers don't belong to RFBND, especially newly blind, and people want to give them a present and everything, and I wanted it to be even more accessible for blind readers. And that's the audiobook version that we have today. Anne's reading of Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision with a Guide Dog by My Side, far better than the printed text could ever be. So I invite you to, it's a gift because, you know, it's a labor of love that we did on top of the book. And the Guide Dog is a gift to me, you know. That's a charity, Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, California. And there are ways in which I try to give back. So I think I would stop at the moment and say that whether you have in the audio form or in the book form, I have a website, which if you went on to susankrieger.stanford.edu, you would find it. Anne has a website that's Her Smooth Voice, hersmoothvoice.com, and that's really neat. So you can find some excerpt also on my website. I hope that you will just enjoy the book, some of the experiences, enjoy it in whatever format, and I would be very glad to answer questions, have any discussion, and if you would like any to be presented to Anne, I think I've asked her, and she would be glad to answer as well.
Thanks so much, Susan and Anne, and I want to remind our radio and online audiences that you're listening to Professor Susan Krieger of Stanford University talking about her book, Traveling Blind, and her experiences. And what you just said reminded me of living in Hong Kong in the 70s, in the early 70s. Not only was it an experience of racial difference because there was, you know, under 1% of the people were not Chinese, but it was from a different time period. You talked about the blind getting everything late. Now Hong Kong, of course, is ahead of us at almost everything, but at that time, The Ten Commandments was playing in first-run movie theaters 15 years after it had been other places. So it was really difficult to be totally outside of what was going on in the culture. And I have one question for Anne before I turn it over to the other thing. I know a lot of movie stars have, or television stars have people come up to them and say, I know you from someplace. Where do I know you from? Do the people do that about your voice? Because I listened to your voice for a month in my car, you know, going back and forth doing things, and I associate your voice just with the front seat of my car. I think it's funny. I don't know if you ever get that, because it's a very distinctive voice.
Yes.
So, who would like to ask the first question? Who has some questions for this insight into a different way of seeing things? Great.
Hi, thank you. I've got two questions, if I can ask. One is, has this condition, for lack of a better word, increased your philosophical standpoint in life? I mean, it seems like you've got a great understanding of the human nature to begin with. And then the second question is, the guide dogs for the blind, is there still a real strong need for guide dogs? And I'm just curious about the facility itself.
Okay, certainly philosophical. Yeah, I think it does. I do think it does, maybe for me and possibly for other people too, because you have to rethink. I have had to rethink many things, including, you know, basically what it means to see something. You somehow feel like you're learning all over again, that a baby, you know, you begin to lose sight, that a baby very first has to be told, this is a cup, this is what a cup is. Just seeing the cup doesn't tell you that it's a cup. And because I see so incompletely, when I walk down the street or anywhere, especially if it's strange, I'll see a thing, but I won't know what it is. And I'll have to guess at what it is and sort of relearn how to know things or how to know them by touch. So yes, especially because it raises these issues of vision and what things are, it makes you more philosophical. And second, with regard to guide dogs, I think I don't have a fact on it, but my impression is that they're increasingly popular, people obtaining a guide dog and feeling comfortable having one and wanting one and needing them. I'm not sure that the need would fade away, since navigation for a blind person is either with a cane, with a guide dog, or without, or often with a sighted guide. But if you need an aid, you need something. And guide dogs are increasingly, I think, being understood by the public, so that people will ask me, are you training that dog? Whereas maybe they could go, huh, you know, what's a dog like that? Or what are you doing with the dog in this space? You know, there's more education about that, and then the word disseminates to blind people, and people who might not previously have thought of it might do it. So I think it's becoming more accepted, and definitely the need for it would continue, as far as I understand it.
Hi, my name is Tricia Knapp, and I'm actually a puppy raiser and a puppy breeder for Guide Dogs for the Blind.
Good.
So I can respond to your question, but I wanted to say, just with so much gratitude, I'm so happy that you're standing up here, and it kind of gets, I get a little choked up, because you're the first person I've ever really heard tell your story, and to know that I've taken this time to care for this, you know, these dogs that I fall in love with and that I give away, and to see what they're doing is just that it's giving you your life back, and in a different way. So I just want to say thank you so much, and I didn't realize.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm very glad you're here.
So to answer your question, guide dogs, there is a very big demand for it, and actually, the demand has changed over the years. And you were more of a typical individual who, it used to be a lot of individuals coming back from war, and now it's more of different people with degenerative diseases is where we have a lot of our people come from. So, and they have about 450 dogs a year that they graduate, and it's a pretty, and there is a waiting list for it, so there's definitely a big need for it, and it is a completely nonprofit organization that, you know, all the work I do is you know, it's my volunteer time, and that the dogs are given, you know, to those in need. So that is yes to that answer. So thank you.
Well, thank you for coming and for speaking and for raising guide dog puppies. The guide dogs, you know, they're kept at the guide dog campus in San Rafael in this organization for 8 weeks, and then called the Puppy Raisers, a family or individual or a group of friends who is willing to do this great thing of raise that puppy. And you know how puppies can be, chew everything. And they raise them according to fairly strict guidelines, I think, for their next 14 months, and then bring them back to the guide dog campus, where for the next 5 months, they'll be trained in how to do actual guide work with a HARTA, wear a harness, how to pull a person, how to know, you know, if I say left, right to her, she knows what I'm saying. She knows to stop at the changes in elevation. And then for the 6th month, I went there and was trained to follow her, do what she already knew. But it is such a selfless thing, especially when you know people are raising puppies, and these are big puppies, and I'm sure they chew up lots of stuff. It is a wonderful gift that you've done, you know, and that the puppy raisers do, and very much appreciate it. So thank you.
You have a special watch. You have the guide dog and so on. Have you tried any other electronic equipment besides, for instance, your computer? Are there GPS things and that kind of thing that are available or that you know about?
Yes, let's see. My electronic equipment, I like electronic equipment. I don't have either enough money or enough time to obtain all of it that I would like. But I do. I have my computer does the talking, and I have a special reader that will read the audiobooks for the blind. And I do not have the GPS. It's fairly expensive, and thus far, I have a partner who tends to help us navigate some of those, you know, streets, so I don't have to do all of that on my own. I don't have a great deal of other equipment that I know of. Yeah, the watch talks. You get to be fairly selective. I know I recently got an iPhone, which I haven't even activated yet, and I'm so looking forward to it because it evidently, when I touch it, it will speak everything to me. And thus far, I've had a phone that will speak somewhat, but not all of it. You know, so I can never know what's in my address book because it just won't read it to me, or it won't read a text message. So I do look all the time at these devices for things that could possibly help me. And I think people do vary. Some people, I have scanner, I have this and that. People vary in what devices are really right for them. But that whole field, I think you're opening up of technology that talks, the technology that can scan and read, the technology that you can input, and the output comes right to you. This is a huge, huge difference for the ability of blind people like me, especially people involved in the reading and writing world. Students, you know, can access the world now through the technological changes and the devices that talk, and especially the computer. So it's a very big field, but I can't say that I have all the unique, fun devices that, you know, might be out there. But I think basically you need a computer, and if you do Braille, you need the refreshable Braille that can work for you, the software that goes into it. You need a talking phone. You need some reading device, some portable device that can be a portable web finder and reader to you. There are little gimmicks and all that come along, like echolocation things that you click and they bounce echoes off things. The GPS things are fairly expensive. And there are always other devices, portable scanners that you can take around and that can read you a menu or something like that and talk it out loud. But a lot of it is converting images to digital, recognizing text and speaking it aloud. So there's an array of these, but there are a good deal of gimmicks too, I think.
I actually just wanted to make an observation. You have the most fabulous smile when you're speaking, and through your experiences, while they might not be easy, your smile actually makes the optimism radiate. And so it's really lovely to actually see you as opposed to just read something. So I just wanted to tell you that.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was a wonderful talk. You're a sociologist, and I'm a sociologist, so we'll have a conversation here, I hope, that others may not understand. I wonder if you could talk about the following aspect of your experience. Now I have to resort to some jargon, but having grown up and been an insider, the experience of blindness now makes you something of an outsider. I mean, a lot of what you were talking about are encounters you are having with people who are sighted, who simply fail to understand the challenges you face or the nature of your condition or the constraints it imposes on you or whatever. And what I'm wondering about is how that impacts your sense of your being in the world now as something of an outsider constantly being confronted with evidence of misunderstanding. Do you understand what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see, to take out this question, yes, I do think this is correct about the outsider status. I think that that's one reason why it has been important for me to identify as a blind person, because then I don't feel so much I'm outside the world of people who see so well, because sometimes that can make me feel bad, like when I walk into a bookstore and everybody else is looking at the books. I'm ready to cry at times that, so I try to keep out of bookstores. But so sometimes, you're right, it does hit me, but especially because I went to guide dog school, that's what I call it, but early on, and met other blind people from an array of different backgrounds who are also getting dogs, some more blind than me, some less blind than me. It gave me a frame of reference for that, and I keep that frame of reference often in mind. I think that's probably a way that I don't have to experience the outsiderness as much. But and I also would mention, you know, one interesting thing about guide dog school to me was that nobody asked anybody what their eye condition was, what was the cause of their blindness, which is usually people want to know if they're sighted. They went, what's wrong with your eyes, and what do you see, and what do you don't see? Nobody asks anybody anything. It was one of the norms, I thought, it was sociologically. But that was interesting, because it's just accepted that you had some reason to be there, and everybody faced so many similar things. So that's been one thing. I also think that the outsider status is not new to me. You know, I think often women have always had that. I'm a lesbian. You kind of get that. And I'm Jewish. And I was raised right after World War II. The Nazis are going to get you. I mean, you're not ever an insider. So I think that this has made me something that it isn't startling at all for me. But definitely, it does place me in that category, and some things bring it up more, like bookstores or... with me, it's often print. It's often the denial of access to print. For instance, I would just like to mention that Google Books, which has that search ability, you know, where anybody can go on, you can preview a book, you can search terms in it, academics use it a lot for research, is totally inaccessible to the blind. When a blind reader, when I go to Google Books, and my partner, who also teaches at Stanford, goes and uses it as a research source, I go to it, and the page is blank. My screen reader can't read it, because they're protecting copyright and putting an image up there of the, it's a picture of the text, a little bit blurry, but it's not the actual digital text, and screen readers that can convert text to something that can be read aloud to a blind person require the digital text, that there be characters there that are recognized as a digital symbol rather than a picture. And yesterday I wrote to Google and I said, I'm going to speak before the Commonwealth Club. I just would like to make an update and ask you, has that changed? Or maybe I can tell, or will it change soon? Maybe I don't want to spread misinformation. I got back a message saying, nope. So these things make me feel very much an outsider. So I think you're right. There are ways in which I might not even be aware of it. And in my case, they have to do with print.
Hi, Susan. I'm wondering if you've ever traveled anywhere where you're actually, whether it's inside of the U.S. or outside, where you were actually surprised by the accessibility that it had?
Thank you. I have not traveled outside the U.S. really, and you mean whether I would be physically surprised by the accessibility that's physically available? You mean that it's more easy to navigate? It's a good question. I think I need to think about it. I haven't experienced that so much because I tend to get lost in any unfamiliar place. And in the book, I do describe just the reverse, where very briefly, and this is outside the U.S., my partner and my guide dog and I crossed the border into Mexico on that first trip that begins in the early part of the book. And we just cross over from southern New Mexico into Mexico, and all of a sudden, The sidewalks are at different levels. She steps down off one, it doesn't lead to another. Things are cracked, things are out in the middle. And all of a sudden, I realized there that things I could take for granted about walking on streets, I couldn't in this other environment, so it was worse. So it did make me more grateful for the more patterned, symmetrical environments that you might have in the United States with roads and curbs and crossings and whatnot. So I do think it can vary, but I'm not as broad a traveler as would be desirable to answer that question further.
Follow up on something Bob said, another point of view in the same thing. Most people in life, we present our image out for the rest of the world to accept, and we're trying to sell this image, essentially, in order to be able to believe in it ourselves a little bit. And I was wondering if you, switching over to having less sight and becoming blind, whether you changed in the image that you project to other people, if you changed in the way that you relate to other people in terms of projecting images as a teacher or any other way, did it affect that or not?
Well, that's a good question. These questions are stressing my ability to give them good justice with my answers. But yes, the image, I'm sure it has affected my presentation. You know, the image, you think it might also mean the presentation of myself to others. Well, the one point is I do then speak more easily and answer to people's questions. I have to do a little more education either about the dog or about blindness or about myself. And I am trying to present an image that is maybe more cool, calm, and collected than I might be inside, because this is what you do in public. And so I think that's so. I do become very composed. I don't want anyone to see me at a loss to the extent that I might suffer problems or troubles or bump my head on the desk when I'm under it on the floor looking for something I have dropped, because I can't look for it because I have to go around and feel for it and spend a lot of time on the floor and also bumping into things. And to the extent that might put me into tears sometime when I'm dealing in the public, I don't talk about that because, I mean, why? You know, and I don't, in the book, primarily talk about when I'm miserable. Occasionally I have a little misery, but I always follow it with something good, because it isn't so that I wish my public presentation to be of the negatives. I don't think I have a poor me about my loss of sight. I think I have an intuitive knee-jerk reaction on my part from the very beginning, which is the world says this is a negative experience. I'll be damned. I'm not having one, and I'm not having a loss. Someone says, oh, I guess you're more limited now because of your loss of sight. Go, limited. I used to say to people a lot, but I'm not sure I like that word. You know, you don't have to see me as well. I didn't want to be seen as any less than. I didn't want to be seen as worse off. I begin to lose sight. People say, oh, I'm so sorry for you. That must be hard. I immediately go, don't be sorry for me. Nothing hard about it. You know, so there is a degree of the public persona that I don't want to be bought into myself. A lot of the negative stereotypes or the negative ways of looking at blindness, because if I've got it, it's got to be fine. And the biggest battle that I've ever had to do with it, I think, has to do with internally counteracting those negative views. For instance, it takes me 5 times longer to read and write. And with my technology and with all the steps you have to take, and it takes me longer to do just about everything, and I have to walk slower most of the time. Now, slow people are dumb people. This is not a positive attribute. You know, so I have to constantly tell myself, you have to take longer time, you have to do this and this, because you have to be safe, and that's what it takes, and you're blind, and you have to wait a long time on the corner for a cab or for a bus, and it's an hour, so it's an hour. That's what happens with blind people. It's not something terrible. It's just life. This is a different life that you have, and there are a lot of positives about this life. And so I can try to convert internally within myself the negatives to a positive to some extent. That's represented in this book, and that is apparent in my public presentations. But it comes from a desire, I think, internally, not to succumb to that negativity, because I do believe that blindness is an experience, and it results in alternate ways of seeing, alternate ways of taking in the world through sight, sound, a little bit sight maybe, but sound, touch, smell, feeling, intuition. Blind people take in the world through living in the world of the sighted. If my partner Estelle Freeman tells me this is what something looks like and this is what it feels like, I can see it in my mind even if I can't see it with my eyes. So it's a different world for me, and it's very important to view that as different, not as less than, lacking, limited, or any which way. And I think that that's a constant internal conversion that I do, and something that probably does affect my persona that I convey outward. That's a long answer to your question.
What a great answer. I think one of the things about the book that I thought was a very great insight, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this, is what it's like to be on the receiving end of this compassion for the disabled. And is this really the way that we should be treating of all different forms of disabled? Is this really useful to the disabled? I mean, you obviously have been not disabled before, so it might be different for people who didn't make a transition that have been disabled their whole lives. But it seems to me that the compassion and the condescending attitude or helpfulness. I'll tell one real brief story. There was one of the NBC news anchors here told a little story about doing a small brief thing for the news about getting your flu vaccines. And she was at a hospital, and there was an elderly man, 85 years old or so, who had just gotten his vaccine, and he was kind of cute as far as she was concerned, so she wanted to put him on the news show. So she went over to interview him and asked him a couple questions about it, and he said sure. She interviewed him. And later on, as she was leaving, she saw him still there, and she said, well, you know, I really ought to tell him he could be on TV. So I went up to him, and I said, you know, sir, you could see yourself on TV tonight at 6:30, around 6:30. And he said, oh, yes. And she said, yeah, if you would like to see yourself on TV, wouldn't that be fun to see yourself on TV? He said, yeah, that would be fine. And she said, have you ever been on TV before? She said, oh, yes, I was on TV once before. She said, when? He said, when I received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. and she said, this is what I love about the Bay Area, but obviously, you know, it gave a totally different perspective, and I thought that was just a great story. So I wanted to talk about a little bit about that, maybe.
Yeah, that's a hard story to top. but I do know what you were suggesting, and I do write a bit, you know, here and there in the stories in the book about this. My personal experience is that a little condescension and offers of help when I don't need it are actually a little condescension, offers of help when I don't need it are actually good. Because my even though sometimes, you know, it's I can do it myself, or, you know, don't look down at me, don't think I'm less than. But my experience is that it is harder for me when my blindness goes unnoticed, and that this is so often an invisible condition, both because maybe I don't look blind, but because people don't assume blindness. You know, I think many, many people, 90% of blind people have some degree of visual sight. Most blind people don't walk with a cane or a dog. You don't even know they're there. And when I could see better, I started noticing them a little more. Like in a supermarket, someone would stand for a long time staring at that shelf. Or I'd see someone in a corner waiting for the traffic light to come around to their turn over and over. And I recognize these things as experiences of a blind person. Now I see less well, so I don't see them. But my experience has been that even when someone offers me to help, you know, offers me help to cross the street, or, you know, they will grab you and try to take you across, even with the dog. And I'll say, stop, I have the dog. But that even when I may not want this help and I don't feel safe crossing the street just when someone else has to cross, because what if the light changes and I'm in the middle? But it means that someone has recognized me as blind, which most often is invisible, and someone has offered to help me in the world. I mean, that's a huge thing. You know, you're not that alone if someone's offered to help you, even if you don't need the help. And so the condescension can be, or the compassion or whatever, it can be awkward sometimes, but it is a recognition of a disability, of a difference, that needs recognizing, because usually it goes unnoticed, and because the large majority of circumstances do not take it into account at all.
Great. Well, we have time for one last question. Would you like to ask another question? Okay, Estelle.
It's not so much a question as a comment, which is that I really urge people to look at the website that Susan mentioned. Susankrieger.stanford.edu? Because the book website is full of visuals. And one of the technologies Susan didn't mention is a self-focusing camera. which is a great boon. And so there's just beautiful pictures of the travels that are described in the book. And I just urge people to take a look at them as you read the book and get to actually see some of this incredible skies and landscape and what and the things that have drawn Susan back to that landscape over the years. So I just wanted to, not so much a question as a comment on some of the other questions.
I should also mention, related to the website, that that was another task of mine, that I wanted to make sure my website would be nice for the sighted as well as the blind. So the website designer did the visuals, and I kept testing and retesting them with my screen reader that reads it aloud to me, and screen readers, the program that blind use to read web pages that reads them aloud, converts everything. They show you everything behind the screen, the list of links, the list of headings, the list of form fields, all this type of stuff, and it all has to be perfectly in order so that it doesn't just say click here, because what's a blind person to do with a web page that says click here? Or if it just says here, because you get your list of links, you go, here, okay, here, let me go to somebody else's website. So that was another example for me of I had this double duty, which I gladly did, but it cost a lot more and took a lot more time to get that website out there. So I'm kind of proud of it because it works for two sets of readers, both of which are important to me, and I hope that you'll be readers too.
Thank you very much once again, Susan Krieger. Thanks to Susan and Anne and Tila for making that possible. And we'd like to, again, thank our audience here and our online audience. And this is the end of another session of enlightened discussion in the 108th year of the Commonwealth Club's history. Thank you.